session number 25186, Real 5.
Ronald Jesse, Real 5. Where were you when the guns were firing on D-Day?
At my station on the throttles of the forward engine room.
This is your action station.
My action station, dressed in anti-flash gear, not knowing quite what to expect, expecting to rush up and down the coast, blasting everything in sight. To my amazement, all we did was to hover.
What was it like when the guns were firing?
A crash and a bang and a shudder, and a crash and a bang and a shudder, and a crash and a bang and a shudder. Not quite as fast as that, but that was it was a monotonous crash and a bang and a shudder. And it is exactly the same sensation as a near miss. If somebody is shooting at you, there's a crash and a bang and a shudder, and the ship shakes. And you get used to this until eventually it fades. If it goes on for a long time, it fades into the background, and you're just watching your duties and what you've got to do, and it fades into the commonplace, if I can use the word. And so it went on, and a little while afterwards, a little while later, we were asked to move on one screw only, so as not to set off any limpet mines that there might have been set in store for us, which are set, not limpet mines, I should say, acoustic mines can be set off by the vibration of the water. So we went on one screw at very slow speed along the coast to help bombard Omaha Beach. We were assigned to Gold Beach to help out on Omaha Beach, which were having a hard time of it. It was so easy, and we were so full of confidence that we relaxed from full action stations, and quite often we were up on deck watching what was going on, because there was absolutely no response from the enemy.
Can you tell me what you saw?
Full of confidence. Poor blighters. They're going to be rolled over. Quite the reverse.
Paint me a picture. Tell me what you saw. What you smelled.
Smoke. Smell of cordite, which also smells rather like blood. And that smell wafted across the whole foreshore. But by looking keenly with one's naked eye, one could see little buildings, but one could see any more detail than the little buildings. And it's a fairly low foreshore. The part we were at, where there were no cliffs. In fact, it was a sea resort, a seaside resort in its heyday. The landing craft were coming out of their parent landing ships, as well as the ones I was talking about, the tank landing craft. Little landing craft were coming out like ducklings from a duck, from a nest, and forming up and going ashore. And the DUKWS, the ducks, the lorries, which were waterproofed for sailing, they were going as well. Most of those were going under, I'm afraid. They were being swamped. There wasn't a lot of shot and shell coming from shore, because we'd swamped it with our bombardment, and the air raids had swamped them as well. The smoke and clouds of dust and smoke from gunfire was shrouding the detail on the shoreline. The flashes of gunfire were only very spasmodic from the shoreline. Much more significant to our way of thinking were the horrendous outpourings of rockets from the rocket ships. We had landing craft fitted with 100 rockets, and when these went off with a whoosh, 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 they would all stream inland, and there'd be a vast series of explosions on shore, and you couldn't help thinking there would be nothing surviving underneath. Our own shots were our own designated targets were taken out in the first quarter of an hour, and we were then put on to ranging further inland, and for the next 6 weeks we went further and further inland, and there were men assigned with radio connections to spot our fall of shot, and I'm told that on one occasion we wiped out an entire tank brigade which were sheltering in the woods. We just, because it's so accurate for a ship which is capable of shooting at a moving target, which is when it is moving itself, it is being so accurate when it is standing still and shooting at another solitary target, stationary target. We were full of confidence. We couldn't help feeling sorry for the poor blighters who were being mown over. Several small ships came alongside to have repairs done to them, and if any repairs, if I were off duty and could help with the repairs, I did them. I did some in the coppersmith shop repairing pipes and things. And I went, jumped down in and helped repair them so that they could go back and help pick up the wounded and that sort of thing.
What sort of ships were they?
Oh, they were small ships, tank landing craft. One was an American Coast Guard cutter. The smaller ships, smaller boats, really. You couldn't look without you saw a ship. It was absolutely black with ships. destroyers, battleships, further off out, booming away. And cargo ships unloading their cargo. There was a chap brought off, who was a Canadian, who had been 2 years training in Canada for this day, and he'd come across and waited his time and gone across on the first wave of landing craft, stepped on a mine and came straight, had to be brought straight back. He came back to the Belfast, where he had severe damage to his foot, and I was asked to make a device which would put a wire through his heel bone for pulling him out straight again by screwing this mechanism, and I can't remember the details now, but I know I worked like frenzy at this to get it done in time for the surgeon to pull his leg out and hold it out whilst he screwed and splintered it. That was my only experience of death and casualties. We had a few shots fall near us from from one of their guns, and splinter wounded one of my messmates. But otherwise, we were walking around the ship. It wasn't serious. We were walking around the ship just as if we were on holiday, really, when we weren't on duty. I saw the captain once standing on top of one of the high parts with a pair of binoculars, trying to identify a gun on the shore that he wished he could know where to shoot at. It was all very casual and confident.
Belfast was there for some time.
And we were there for 6 weeks. We took up various parts of the coast as our allotted area. After 3 weeks, we came back to replenish with ammunition to Portsmouth, and then went out for another 3 weeks. It wasn't until the fighting had got beyond range of our guns round about Caen that we had to pack up. We had worn our gun barrels out and had to go back to Portsmouth to have a new set fitted. It became routine. You know, that's a terrible thing to say, but it became routine. You just, we shall be firing in 5 minutes' time, and bang, 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 and you got on with what you were doing without paying any attention to it. I do remember the Mulberry Harbour. It was quite rough, and the Mulberry Harbour was a first of all a set of sunken ships which formed a breakwater, and then it was a more sophisticated device made out of concrete moles, and it was severely damaged by a storm that blew up. It didn't bother us in the Belfast. We had two anchors out, and that was that. But it was all blown hither and yon, and it was a bit of a mess for quite some time until it was restored. I remember a 1,000 bomber raid that went over. Plane after plane after plane, in formation, one after the other, and they went over. It looked like half an hour, seemed like half an hour, and then in the distance you could see the tinsel falling, which was a radar blind, and each airplane dropped its little bits of tin foil, aluminium foil, to baffle the enemy's radar. And this came down as a sheet, and then boom, 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 and they were bombing somewhere inland with 1,000 bombers. It was tremendous. Tremendous. I have fortresses. And then we heard of the V1 weapon starting to go over. But that's another story, I expect.
Any other memories of that time?
No.
What happened after the Belfast had completed her duties in respect of the D-Day landings?
With the European war drawing to a close, the Belfast was prepared with the extras needed for fighting in the Pacific Ocean. We had been fitted out with Arctic steam heating for work in the Arctic Ocean, and all that had to be stripped out, which is a considerable job. Extra ventilation had to be installed, which is fans and trunking and considerable upheaval. We were made to bristle with short range weapons with the kamikaze threat in mind, and this took some few months. The ship was painted to a different colour, which reflects the difference in the type of sea that we're going to fight in. The northern waters are dark and grey, and so the ships had dark grey camouflage. In the Pacific, it's blue and it's pale grey, so we had a pale grey finish to us. And off we went to the wars again. This would be 45, the early parts of 45. We had a new crew. Elements of the old crew, technical elements of the old crew, had been retained to give continuity, and I was one. And so off we went for another commission with a new crew, and we had to work the ship up to a fighting efficiency again on our way out to the Pacific Ocean. We arrived in Gibraltar, I remember, and the first thing that was, we arrived one morning, and the first thing that was said was, there will be no sunbathing. Anybody found to be suffering from a sunburn will be put on a disciplinary charge. And so, however lovely and warm it was, we had to keep our shirts on and definitely not sunbathe. And we spent some time working up in Gibraltar, and then off we went out to the Far East via Malta, Suez, Aden, Colombo. At each stop, we merely refueled and on we went again. The catchphrase was, we must get there at all speed in order to support our American brothers in arms. As we were coming from Colombo down to the western coast of Australia, the atom bomb went off, was used. then there was a considerable shock throughout the ship that such an enormous weapon had come from nowhere and put an end to the war. We were half thankful and half regretful, if you know what I mean, because we had worked ourselves up to be a fighting unit and clearly were not going to be used as such. However, on we went, and the next day, our meteorological officer gave a lecture in one of the hangars, which are now empty because we had discharged our walrus airplanes. Quite a convenient place for holding mass meetings. He gave a lecture on the atomic bomb, because he had been a scientist involved in the preparation of the bomb in its early phases. He had seen ahead what the result would be and had decided not to have any part of it and had joined the Navy as a theoretical scientist and was our meteorological officer. And that was quite stunning, that talk that he gave us then. We arrived in Sydney, and the thing I remember about Sydney is that the pubs closed at 5 o'clock. Shore leave was allowed from 4 o'clock, and so you had to work like crazy to get yourself a drink before the pubs closed. They kept their beer. It was very frothy, and they drew it off into big glass jugs, sort of 3 or 4 pint jugs to defroth before it was poured in. Otherwise, they couldn't pour it fast enough. And the working men in Sydney, the dockyardmen and so on, had to cram a couple of pints in about 5 minutes because they stopped work until five. So that was Sydney. Off we went up Pacific, as you might say, to join the British Pacific Force, which was working alongside the American fleet train. You may have heard that expression. And our first task was to sail closed up for action stations, a harbour in Okinawa. I can't remember the name of the harbour. It has a modern name anyway, but the old-fashioned name of the island was Okinawa. And we fully expected the Japanese to fight to the last shell, as it were, and give us some trouble, but nothing happened, and we accepted their surrender. Our admiral, who was admiral of, the second cruiser squadron, accepted their surrender, and we left in a few days. We went.
Can I ask you, was there any ceremony involved in that?
No ceremony. He handed his sword to the admiral, and that was that. The main ceremony was in Tokyo Bay some days later.
Did you see that?
No, I wasn't. We weren't there. We went on to Shanghai.
Were there any celebrations for the end of the war?
None at all. I don't recall any celebration at all. We had a job to do, and we got on and did it. We had to go around all the British dominions, rescuing, if that's the right word, our prisoners of war who'd had a horrendous time under Japanese domination. We went to Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, the Fiji Islands. Going into Shanghai, the most curious thing is that, I suppose it's the same today, but you have to wait outside the bar until the tide's absolutely right, and then you pound over the bar at full speed in order to get across it before the tide fell again. And as you go across at full speed, a huge wave at the back of the ship that follows you in, and the water is decidedly yellow and murky. It's the Yellow River that comes down through that estuary. So into Shanghai, and the expats that we had coming on board to have a decent meal and a medical checkup and so on were in the most pathetic state. They were thin and knobbly-kneed, cheerful, of who asked to be released, but they were very weak and pathetic is the word I think I want to use. And we lost no time in cheering them up.
How did you do that?
Entertaining them, taking them onto our messes, talking to them about home, and generally showing the flag, and that they would come out, they would go back to resurrect their quarters in Shanghai or Hong Kong, whichever it was, and come out again the next day. We had hundreds of them crowding over the ship, just pleased to seeing nationals again. The money situation was horrendous. You could go ashore and do whatever you wanted to do for the cost of a bar of soap. They would pay you huge local currency for a bar of soap, and that would sustain you for the few hours that you were spending ashore. It wasn't wise to drink anything or eat anything because the bottles would be tampered with. And once or twice we found that the bottle had a hole drilled in the bottom and the contents taken out and the rice wine put back in its place. And then the hole covered up again. And this is not good stuff to be drinking. Several of our shipmates had to have their stomachs pumped after that. So I didn't get involved in anything like that.
Do you remember any of your trips ashore? What you did? Did you go sightseeing?
Yes, I went sightseeing, and I remember trying hard to find that the real Shanghai or the real Hong Kong. In Shanghai, I remember going out and walking with a friend in the sort of outskirts, and the house had a big heap at the bottom of the garden, and I asked through an interpreter what that heap was, and they said it's our forebears, and everybody gets buried in this at the end of the garden, and there were tomatoes growing on the top. And I thought to myself, well, okay, that's one way of putting your forebears to good use. Make a compost heap of them. In Hong Kong, we walked to the top of the hill. I'm not sure what it's called. There's a mountain at the top of Hong Kong. We walked to the top, and there had been a monument at the top at the time of the Japanese occupation, and the Japanese had made our prisoners take the monument down and carry stones up to build a monument of their own. And I was very pleased to see that we were now making the Japanese soldiers march up the hill, and carry their monument down and put ours back up again. In Singapore, we came across some German prisoners of war from a German submarine which had sailed all the way to Japan and was bringing precious metals back from Japan. It had been sunk and the crew captured, and we put them to work in our engine rooms or wherever they were capable of working, and I was intrigued to discover that they were very pleased to be doing something useful with their skills. They weren't in the least embarrassed that it was for a British ship. They were sailors and they were doing repairs as if it were their own ship, and they were pleased to be productively occupied rather than just sitting in a prison somewhere.
How were they treated by the ship's company?
Very well. They were just accepted as sailors the same as us. That suffered misfortune.
What was it like living in a tropical climate?
Almost always trickling with perspiration. Unfortunately, we did have cockroaches on board, and when I went on watch in the engine room, I could feel trickling coming down my face, and the times when I felt trickling going up my face, I knew I had a cockroach in my hat, because we kept our hats in a cubby hole in the bathroom, our hats and overalls, and you had to shake the cockroaches out before you put them on. So always hot. The engine room ventilation points were aimed at where the watchkeepers stood for their duties, and one would just open one's shirt and let the cold air blow down, and that was quite comfortable. When you had to go away from that point, it got extremely uncomfortable. To offset the loss of salt, we had containers called fannies, which you hang up in the draft to keep them cool, full of ice water with salt in, and you were required to drink so much of this liquid through the course of your watch to replace the salt that you were losing. Other than that, and the general discomfort of hot nights, it wasn't too bad. I scrounged a camp bed from the Americans, and I slept on the upper deck as often as I could. The only snag with that was that the sailors would be called at 6 o'clock to wash the decks down as a routine, and so you had to disturb yourself and hurry back down underneath again and down below again. Otherwise, they'd squirt you with their hoses. But that was very pleasant, sleeping on the upper deck, especially at sea, if it wasn't rough weather, beneath the stars. That was very pleasant.
Did you experience any rough weather whilst you
were? We were going through a typhoon, through the edge of a typhoon on one occasion, and I have a picture of it in my collection with the waves twice as high as the ship. And you just gently go into the waves and ride it out until the storms passed. I was very interested always to go onto the upper deck, what was called the flight deck, where there are a line across the deck of plates that are designed to ride over each other as the ship bends. And I measured it once, and it was 2.5 inches of movement on these plates. And the thing was, if they hadn't been allowed to bend, the ship would have cracked. So we were very pleased to see the bend, the sliding of the plates. Yes, that was only one occasion when the weather was really severely rough. We after the first round of restoration of our interests in the Pacific, places of interest, we went from Japan to New Zealand in one hop, and that is about a 10-day trip at economical speed. It's such a boring journey that occupations were designed where people could study arts and crafts, and I was put to running classes in coppersmithery, and I had the boys come along and make tin boxes and little copper trinkets and things, and that was very interesting, and I think they all enjoyed it. I'm sure I did.
I remember you saying before we started recording that you made some things for the Belfast some time ago before you actually went on board.
Yes, they were ashtrays of a special design, designed by the commander who had been in charge of the engine room of the Edinburgh when the Edinburgh was sunk. And one of the reasons it was sunk was that litter, cigarette ends, clothing had fallen in and blocked the pumps, and he had us make 50 ashtrays for distribution around the ship, where you would put your cigarette end in and nothing could come back out again because it had a self-sealing entry. And we made these, and as far as I'm aware, they are on the ship to this day. they were made in brass, and they were very, very nicely made indeed. of course.
Sorry, Michael, you're going to New Zealand.
Yes, we're going to New Zealand.
In fact, actually, better stop then. Ronald, Jesse, Real, 6. You're about to talk about your visit, or the Belfast visit, to New Zealand.